And I left you with a couple of questions, it seems, I didn't intend to leave you with. So let me connect a few things for you. We have our system Hamiltonian. I'm going to write it as sigma dot sigma today. And I'll connect it in just a second. We had these two terms, and we said that this piece, which is called the chemical shift, arises because we have a nucleus that's surrounded by some electron cloud in some static field. And by Lenz's law, the electron cloud introduces a small opposing field. And so the field that the nucleus actually sees is reduced from that of the applied field. And it's reduced by an easily observed but small amount. And because it depends upon the electron cloud, it depends uniquely on the chemistry. So every chemical species will, in general, have its own unique shift. And of course, because it's a Lenz law type interaction, the shift is dependent upon the magnetic field. The stronger the field, the more, it's just linearly dependent on that. This term is a coupling term, and it's from the Fermi contact mechanism. And if I have, let's look at this. Let's imagine that I have a C13, which is a spin 1/2, and then a proton. And we know that a proton is going to have some s orbital. And the C13, well, in general, it'll have a hybridization of s and p orbitals. And so it depends upon the geometry that it's in, but there'll be some combination of p and s that will be a hybrid. And the molecular orbital, of course, is the orbital that's composed of those orbitals, right? And so we have a molecular orbital here. And the Fermi contact term says that I have an amplitude which is some geometric factor. The overlap of the magnetic moments of the electron and nuclear spins times the probability that they overlap, which is the electron wave function at the nucleus. And so the Fermi contact mechanism, it tells us what is the interaction of the electron and magnetic moments at, of course, the nucleus, because otherwise there's going to be no interaction. And this term tells us what happens at one of these nuclei. Okay? And of course, we get the wave function, the amplitude of the wave function at the origin, because that's the only place that the nucleus is sitting. And therefore, because of this term, it's only going to be the s orbitals that can contribute, because the p orbitals or d orbitals or f orbitals have nodes at the origin, right? And so we have this simple mechanism. Now, of course, the coupling constant comes in as this thing at one species multiplied by the other. So you have to stitch it together based upon the structure of the molecular orbital. And just to make it clear, if I take acetylene, or an acetylene fragment, I don't care what happens on that side, or if I take an ethene, or if I take a methyl fragment, then of course you know that the hybridization of the carbon varies for these, right? That we go from hybridization of sp3 to sp2 to sp. And so in that molecular orbital, the fractional contribution of the S character goes up as we go up the board, and so the coupling constants become stronger. Yeah? All right. So this is the origin of the Fermi contact mechanism. And because it has this overlap, then of course fundamentally it comes in as sigma dot sigma. All right. Now in the tutorial that those of you that had one yesterday, you saw that the commutator and now I'm guessing, so you can throw something at me and say something soft and say, no, I didn't see that. But if you didn't, it's an easy thing to show that the commutator of sigma z plus sigma z in this term goes to zero, and that the commutator of sigma z minus sigma z, now, of course, that commutes with the zz part of this, right? So just to right. So it commutes with the ZZ part, of course. And so the only piece that I really care about is this term. And this is not equal to zero. And it's useful to rewrite this in terms of the raising and lowering operators. So now we can get a little bit of insight into the problem. Let me draw up the energy level diagram here. So we have energy and there's four levels. And let's call the first one A and the second one B. And then, of course, this piece here is separated by omega A, right? Because the omega A spin flipped. But the B spin is up. And so there's a contribution from the coupling that's positive. And over here, of course, the A spin flipped, but there's the coupling term, the B spin is negative, is pointing down, and so the coupling term comes in negatively. You know, that's the same thing that we saw yesterday, just writing out things in terms of the idempotents. And then here, of course, we have omega B minus omega, the coupling term, and here we have omega B plus the coupling term. Right, so now we have all of our energies fixed. Now, given that the energies are fixed, let's look at this term. So if I take that term as an operator, then what does it do? It says that I can take two spins that are anti-aligned and I can flip them both. So it connects this operator, connects those two levels. And if, when we're looking at those two levels, excuse me, if there's no energy difference between those, so if omega A is equal to omega B, then flipping those two is energy conserving. And if it's energy conserving, that's what we mean by secular, right? And so then we would say, oh, yes, in the case that omega A is equal to omega B, which is this case here, then we need to include this term because it's a secular piece of the Hamiltonian. And we'll see tomorrow that when we do that, that this four-level system will fall into a triplet and a singlet, something that you've seen in quantum mechanics, I hope, before. When the difference in energy is large compared to the coupling constant, then, of course, that transition is forbidden. And then it's safe to drop it out of this term because it's only going to show up as a perturbation. Okay? Good. Now, we saw that it's useful to have this term in the Hamiltonian if we wanted to have a swap gate. Remember that we showed that this term is the generator of a swap gate. Generator means it's the Hamiltonian. And that the sigma z piece, that nice piece, well, that leads to, of course, a conditional phase shift. And that's what we used to build the control NOT gate yesterday. We could have built a control NOT gate based upon a sigma dot sigma interaction, but it would have been a little bit more complicated. And I asked you to look at that. And so before I do it here, let me remind you of the Carpersell sequence. So we have a pi pulse, and let's just put it along x. It doesn't make any difference. And there's a timing of delta, 2 delta, and delta. Over here, this is the system Hamiltonian. And there's nothing in there that we're going to control experimentally. You might tell me that I could control this field experimentally, but it turns out to be really a miserable thing to do. And there's no reason to do it. And of course, I can't control easily the electron density. So those terms are given. So this piece is given and it's fixed in time. But still, I can ask, hey, in a particular interaction frame where I add pulses, I could compose any Hamiltonian I like. And I can compose these Hamiltonians by saying, let's move into a frame of reference that moves with these pulses. And so if I take the term delta omega sigma z, so this is an operator in a Hamiltonian. And then I think about an interaction frame for these pulses. Then during this time, of course, we haven't done anything. And so we see the same thing. Here, of course, we've applied a pi pulse to the spin about the x-axis. And so that's going to take our operator sigma z to minus sigma z. And so here, in the frame of reference given by these pulses, so in that interaction frame, we pick up a negative sign. And of course, we undo the negative sign there. And so the average of that simply goes to zero. And in this case, it's a particular nice feature that everything commutes with itself at all times. And so the average is truly the correct answer in this case. Of course, if things didn't commute with themselves at each element in time, then we'd have to crank up the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula and take into account the non-commutivity. Okay, so here we say, oh, well, on average, over this, it's called a cycle, but you don't need to remember that, this process, the effective Hamiltonian is equal to zero. And of course, we saw that when we looked at the spin dynamics, that we could use a series of pi pulses to remove linear terms. We also saw that if I had a term that was bilinear in Z, we'll put some frequency there, though it doesn't matter, that in each of these windows, of course, it would remain. Right? That here it would be positive, here it'd be positive, here it'd be positive, and the average is in fact just the original piece. Because a collective rotation of x you can think about it two ways. This rotation commutes with that state, therefore everything goes through. Okay? Or you say, well, it doesn't change the state. Right? So now we have our ability to control the Hamiltonian on average over time. Right? Okay. So then I asked you to do two things. The first is to take the operator sigma z and transform that so that the average is proportional to sigma dot sigma. And separately, with another sequence, take sigma dot sigma and transform that so that on average, this is proportional to sigma z. All right. So let's take the first one. I'm going to tell you that you can do it with two pulses where the times are the same. And I'd like to, but it's not essential, include a third pulse so that I can keep running this forever. And here, you can do this with one pulse. Okay, so now then, you have 3 minutes to, with your neighbors, come up with the answers here. There isn't, of course, only one answer. And I'll tell you, it's more effective to think about what states you want than to think about the pulses. If you figure out what states you want, you can usually figure out the pulses. Okay, let's see where we're at. So for the first example, what state do we want here?
Well, we could have sigma x, sigma x.
That's a good one. And therefore, the state we want here?
Here, that would be in at the beginning of the second pulse.
Right here.
I guess that could be sigma x, sigma x plus sigma z, sigma z.
So we're trying to create this, right, which is sigma x plus sigma y plus sigma z, right? So we have sigma z here in sigma x, so I want sigma y there, so that when I average over these, I'll end up effectively having this dot product, yeah? Okay. What pulse takes us between this?
Well, it's pi of rotation.
Why?
Now here, because we're going into this interaction frame, remember I want to make this one relative to here. So then we say, oh yes, I want a pulse here such that when I take this state and I apply this pulse and then I apply this pulse, I end up with z. And so here we end up with a pi over 2 x pulse. And the reason I like to have a pulse here is I imagine repeating this cycle many times. So I want to get back to a ZZ operator. And then for me, the pulse I want, rather than these, is a pi over 3 pulse about the magic angle. And then I can put that everywhere. Let me show you that. But this would work fine. There's nothing wrong with that solution. But the magic angle pulse is a little bit nicer. And it's the bisector of a cube. So it's the 1-1-1 direction. And if I rotate a cube by its bisector, then I'll rotate z into x, x into y, and y into z. And of course, the rotation is 2 pi over 3. And you can see that we could just apply that same pulse over and over again. Yeah, you have a question.
I think you get it, but I didn't understand. So why is the second one around x and not z?
So that's a good question. Because I'm transforming into a reference frame relative to here. And so you have to take the effective action over all of the pulses. And so then I'll say, OK, I want to take sigma z, the initial state. I'm going to apply to that a rotation about y. So that's let me just write it as a rotation about y of pi over 2. And then I'm going to apply a rotation about x of pi over 2. Right? You know, because I'm looking at the interaction frame, I can't get them backwards. I can't neglect all of the pulses. Yeah? And so you say, well, OK, this one's going to take zz into yy, then this pulse on y won't do anything. And so we end up with the yy state. OK? Now, let's look here. It's most useful to remember that we have three terms here. And we apply a single pulse. And so what do I want for those three terms on the other side?
Negative sign in front of sigma x and x and sigma y sigma y.
Yeah. And then if the times are equal, everything's good. OK, what pulse does that? Yes?
Pi rotation about z for 1 cubit.
Perfect. So we rotate 1 cubit, let's say a, about z. And that will give us that piece. And then, of course, we say, well, we don't actually have a z rotation, so this has to be a pi over 2 rotation about minus y of a pi rotation about x of a, and a pi over 2 about plus y of a. But the hard part is that. You get that piece right. And then, of course, you know, again, we would add another one here so that we could repeat the cycle over and over and over again. OK, so now you say, yes, we can take our Hamiltonian. We can transform it into some other Hamiltonian at a cost that says we get that Hamiltonian on average over some process. And in this case, of course, these things all commute. So the average is good, too. There's nothing we have to do. Yeah? And so there's the person who came up with this, John Waugh, nicely described the physics. It was only in the early 70s that this idea that you could apply coherent averaging, that you could modulate the Hamiltonian. Up until that point, it was always thought that if nature gives you a Hamiltonian, you have to suffer with it. And then John said, no, you can do anything you want. I have a nice vision of him at a lecture, standing up with a podium, and in response to someone's question from the audience, pounding the podium and saying, you can create any Hamiltonian you want. And then they ask the question, and he pounds it some more and says, you can create any Hamiltonian you want. So if you have universal control, you can create any Hamiltonian you want. And of course, if you can create any Hamiltonian you want, then one of the nice things you can do is to say, I want to map this into some interesting Hamiltonian so that I simulate the action over that interesting Hamiltonian. So years ago, we showed that you could take NMR, you could make it look like a harmonic oscillator, because my theory friends all like harmonic oscillators. Of course, anything you want, you can do. Okay, good. So now I want to add the last piece on magnetic resonance. Which is to look quickly at relaxation and to see how a system and environment interact with each other. And of course, in the neutron interferometry case, we couldn't get that. Of course, if I have a beam of neutrons, there is relaxation because neutrons decay. And so with a lifetime of 10.3 seconds, a neutron will turn into a proton, and it'll have a neutrino, an electron, and there's a photon, and life is good. But remember that in the neutron interferometry case, we only count the neutrons that hit the detector, right? We're not normalizing to the neutrons that enter the interferometer. And so we're effectively doing a post-processing that removes all the effects of that lifetime that says, okay, there's effect, no change in the beam intensity, because we're not going to allow that piece to enter our experiment. So here, I want to pick a simple model. I'm going to take a spin 1/2 as our system. And we'll allow it to have a Zeeman interaction. So, and we'll keep track of that as a system. And we'll start off by just having an environment that is a single spin 1/2 particle. And I'm going to connect these two. So there needs to be a system environment coupling to enable this. And the system environment coupling, we're going to look at two examples. One is going to be proportional to sigma z, sigma z. And then other one is going to interact as sigma dot sigma. Now, if I have an environment, I need to get rid of information in the environment, right? And so I'm going to introduce here a channel that has T1 relaxation just on the environment spin. And I'll make it a really simple one. We'll say that there's some probability that we have a sigma x operation on the environment, and then so this is T1 of the environment. And then there's a probability that we do nothing. And so the T1 process, in this case, is our way of getting rid of noise. And of course, all of this would be tensored, the system being unchanged by that process. Yes?
Sorry, I think I lost track of the bigger picture. Why are we talking about neutrons again?
We're not.
Okay.
So my point was that if we went back to the neutron as, you know, the archetype clean system, we didn't see any relaxation in there, right? Because we excluded it by the way we did our measurement. So we're back to spins, no neutrons. So I have two spin one-half particles, my system, the Hamiltonians for the coupling, and our ability to remove coherence from the piece. And there's an additional feature you want to include. That the initial density matrix is separable. So there's no memory of what went on before you sat down at your spectrometer. And in fact, I'm just going to set the environment to the identity state. There's no reason. I'm not trying. The only reason for setting the environment to something other than the identity is if I wanted to use the environment to create a thermal equilibrium here. And I'm not going to do that. We're just going to look at the loss of coherence in this system via the environment. Okay. So now, in the notebook that you have, I define everything exactly as I defined it on the board. And we start off looking at the superoperator. So the superoperator, of course, is the map of what happens to the spin system. And here, we say, I've got this map for no time. It's just nice to check that if I look over the system-only degrees of freedom, so the map for the system only has the four polys, the identity sigma x, sigma y, sigma z. And if I look at no time, then I better get the identity. So I haven't programmed things hopelessly wrong. And if I allow the system to evolve, then, of course, here, what do we see? We see that the identity stays. That's not surprising, right? That sigma x gets transformed slightly into sigma y. Sigma y gets transformed slightly into sigma x. And that there is nothing that happens with sigma z. And if I take this term here is the resonance frequency, the Larmor frequency of the system. If I take that term to zero, so that I don't see these oscillations, then I see a map which directly tells me that there's a T2, right? So that if there's no oscillations, there's no Zeeman precession, then the diagonal elements are just telling me over the time course of this map, let me map sigma x into sigma x, sigma y into sigma y, sigma z into sigma z. And of course, we see that because there's a T2 process, that the x and y components of the density matrix for the system are attenuated. Right? The fact that these two are not one says over this short time step, there's exponential attenuation. And when I look at the system and I only allow a ZZ coupling, then I see only T2 on the system. T1 of the system remains infinite. Right? There's no T1 relaxation. And I hope that that makes sense to you, that the environment is rotating the system about the z-axis. Right? If it's rotating the system about the z-axis, then it can't do anything to the z-state of the system spin. Now, yeah, please.
So if the environment is rotating the system spin about the z-axis, so it makes sense that something is happening to the x and y components of the system spin. But why the attenuation to that rotation?
Because I have some random piece over here, right? So the environment is pushing the system a little bit about the z-axis, and then it forgets which way it pushed, right? It gets reset to the identity, and then it tries to push it again. And each of those pushes you can think of as being random. So your question says, hey, what happens in the environment? So if we look at this reduced superoperator over just a system, of course, it doesn't tell us everything. And so then we look at this, come on, this big wonking thing. Let's look at this one. Over the system and the environment. And we see that more things are happening. And let me just tell you that in this 16 by 16 matrix, the fifth element, as I've ordered these, is sigma x of the system spin tensored with the identity on the environment spin. So if we had the system, and there was only T2 relaxation, then sigma x would go to sigma x of the system, and that would be it. If we add Zeeman interaction, right? We add a Zeeman interaction, then sigma x of the system goes to sigma y of the system, and it goes to sigma x of the system. And we can put sines and cosines and exponents there. That's all trivial. So if it was only system dynamics, there would be two terms. But now if we have system environment, so now I have the environmental coupling, then sigma x identity also goes to sigma y of the system, sigma z of the environment, right? Because there's a zz operation. And so at the end of the day, adding everything together, we see four terms that arise out of this. And two of them tell us about the memory of the environment. And so if we look at the fifth column, we see, in fact, that there are four terms there. We can, from that, measure all the rates. I show you in the notebook that you can calculate. That's bad. Yeah. So we're mapping every operator to every operator in the superoperator. In this figure, that label should be T2. But we can calculate the effective T2 of the system as a function of the coupling. That's easy. We could even label it correctly. We can calculate the evolution. That's easy. But let's look at this plot. Well, here, there's the evolution of the system. We see exactly what we expect, that we start off in sigma x, it alternates between sigma x and sigma y, and there's a decay, and the decay looks roughly exponential. If I look at this term, then we can see that we build in a memory into the system, and that that memory oscillates just like the system does, because it's a memory of the system. So it should oscillate like the system. And it decays, right? So we slowly lose our memory because we have a T1 relaxation event. But of course, there is a memory in the system. And if I increase the coupling, or let me put it differently, if I reduce the relaxation rate of the system, so let me take this value and make it long. The longer I make T1, of course, the more memory it will have of the system. Then we see some more complicated dynamics. So here I'm looking at the behavior of just the system. So I've traced out the environment, and you can see that it no longer looks exponential, nor does it have a single frequency, that we're seeing here the structure of the environment already in the system. And if I plot out the same measure here, the same operator of saying, how much memory have I stored, we also get this complicated picture of the memory left in the environment. And so, okay, so now then we say, okay, we have a system environment coupling. We can map the whole thing correctly. We see that this piece here leads only to T2 relaxation. And that it's important that we find a way of losing the information in the environment. And this isn't a very good way. So what one likes to do is to take the system, have a coupling to the environment, and then the environment couples to many spins, etc. And so that the information, you can think about the information as moving out through this network. So take all those couplings to be sigma dot sigma type interactions. And this is a good model for the system. We can parameterize it perfectly. So we can write it down for a certain system, and we can tell you every frequency in the Hamiltonian. And of course, we can't solve it, because it's a nice multi-body problem. It's been an open question in physics since the early 50s. There's a lot of insight into what we can learn about from this. So we've learned a lot, but in fact, we haven't learned enough to tell us, can we suppress information in the environment sufficiently that we can do quantum computing? So what I don't want in a quantum computer is to run my processor and for there to be an echo of that process sitting in the environment. Now, let's just change to this. If I change to sigma dot sigma coupling, and then here, I look again at the superoperator in the system space, so in the reduced space. Then we see, not surprising, that if we have a sigma dot sigma interaction, then we have T1 relaxation as well as T2 relaxation. Right? Good. And that There's more in the notebook, but that's basically the story I want to tell you about from there. It's absolutely it's absolutely straightforward to, in these systems, describe in terms of a Hamiltonian what's going on with the system. And you know, you guys can tell us someday, given that we've described a Hamiltonian, what can we learn from it? Now, I want to transition out of NMR to an electron spin. So if we go back to David DiVincenzo's rules of you need these ingredients for building a quantum computer, his first rule, remember, was that we needed a scalable map from the physical system to qubits. And this, we sort of have. That if I think about this in liquid state, and so I have a molecule, and I want to have a network of spins, then we can have a big network of spins. And in terms of custom designing big molecules, remember that we can grow any protein or any DNA that you like. You say, I want this DNA, we can grow that DNA. So we can make big molecules. In the solid state, these are well connected. In the liquid state, because we're limited by the Fermi contact mechanism, everything locally is looking like it's moving along a chain. And that's a problem. In the solid state, we can move in three dimensions. So I say, well, okay, we don't know how to do this, but that's not really the hardest part. We need to initialize the qubits. And so far, what did we say? That our equilibrium or thermal density matrix, let's just think about it for two spins. Looked like that, where epsilon is really small. And if I have a pure state of qubits, then the initial state that I want is this, which we can expand out like that. And I really should put a factor of 4 here and put it like that to be consistent. And of course, these two are not close to the same. Now I can take this set system and I can apply two steps. We've shown that we can map any operator into any operator. So I can take these two operators and in one step map it just into what it is. So that doesn't cost me anything. And in another step, I can map it into this. I won't show you the pulse sequence, but it's trivial. The same things we've been talking about earlier this morning. And then I can take these two density matrices and add them and get the term that looks like that. And now you recognize that this piece of it looks like that. And so then I would say, oh, I can create a state whose shifted density matrix, in other words, I've removed a piece of the identity, is isomorphic to a pure state. The system is, of course, not pure. But it transforms. Isomorphic means it transforms like a pure state. And so we can make a system that, if I restrict myself to this piece, then I say, oh, well, OK, it'll look like. Now, of course, there's a cost, because I have to add copies of the system. And it turns out that this cost is exponential. And you know, we'll agree in doing quantum computers that we don't accept any exponential costs as being for free. Every exponential cost really costs. Okay, so this is not a good way to build a quantum computer. But you can prepare states that allow you to see aspects of a pure quantum dynamics. Okay. So we'll say, hey, this one we don't get. Universal control, that we have. Qubit specific measurement. We've got that. And to control noise. We have this limited by our inability to do this. Okay? And I've run out of time. So what I'm going to do next class is I'm going to show you that by adding an electron spin, adding a spin 1/2 particle, that we can remove that limitation of initializability. That we can add an electron spin as a coherent part of our processor. And whereas today we can't measure a single nuclear spin, we can measure a single electron spin. We can reset an electron spin. And we can do this by optics. We can do it by transport. We can do it by coupling to a cavity. And we can do it by coupling to some bizarre fields, which I'm not going to tell you about. But we can take our system, keep everything about it, keep all the aspects of control that we have, and then add to it a way of resetting and initializing the system so that we capture all of David's requirements and then start down our path to building a computer. Yeah?
What is then the final hurdle? Why don't we do it then?
Jeez, we're doing it, man. Listen to this guy. He said, well, why don't we have a quantum computer already? It's because you haven't joined the group to build it. So we'll talk about that on Friday. But building a quantum computer remains a hard process. And we don't know everything. So yes, there are systems that apparently fulfill the DaVincenzo requirements. But that doesn't necessarily mean that if we look, if we treat these as a yes-no question, we don't look in more detail, that answering yes to each of these may not be enough to build a quantum computer. Okay, we'll see some aspects of why.